From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Gunfire brings calls for unity on Capitol Hill. Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney, and this is To the Point.
An attack on one of us is an attack on all of us.
That was House Speaker Paul Ryan after a shooting spree targeting Republicans practicing for a charity baseball game this morning in Northern Virginia. Majority Whip Steve Scalise of Louisiana is out of surgery. Four other people also were injured. The lone gunman was killed. We'll hear what happened at the scene as both parties call for unity, at least for the moment. When they get back to business as usual, can Democrats formulate a common strategy for the upcoming elections? That's our main topic today. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
I'm Armin Olney, back with To the Point. In Virginia's Democratic primary for governor yesterday, a candidate of the liberal wing was soundly defeated by a party regular. We'll look at the potential consequences as voters for change in the party challenge the status quo. First, this news update, Republican Majority Whip Steve Scalise of Louisiana is in critical condition after being shot during a blaze of gunfire this morning during a practice for a charity baseball game. His colleague, Jimmy Duncan of Tennessee, was on the field, left early, says he encountered the shooter.
I did have an interaction with someone in the parking lot who asked me if the team practicing was a Democrat or Republican team. I told him they were Republicans. He said, "Okay, thanks," turned around. I got in the car and left, find out that my Republican colleagues were targeted by an active shooter today.
Charles Fleischman of Tennessee was walking in from left field. He heard shots, dived behind home plate, and then jumped into the first base dugout.
When I got in the dugout, I realized there was blood all over the place. It was not a good place to be. There was a child in the dugout, Congressman Barton's son. Children come out to the practices because this is supposed to be a very safe, wonderful place. It always has been over the past 7 years. Just a terrible day.
The shooter acted alone. He's been identified as James Hodgkinson from Illinois. He was shot to death by Capitol Police on the scene to guard Congressman Scalise because he's part of the House leadership. Peter Jamieson is covering the story for The Washington Post. Peter, good to have you with us.
Happy to be here.
So the situation was that the shooter himself was behind third base, and behind first base were these people from the Capitol Police who were guarding Scalise, and they are the ones who managed to take him down.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it's interesting to note that this could have potentially been much worse had the Capitol Police not been on the scene. They were there exclusively as security for Representative Scalise because of his senior position in the House leadership. But had they not been there, you know, this was a situation where the gunman, we now possessed a rifle and a pistol. Police were trying to trace a pistol for him as well. And, you know, he had the drop on a cluster of people in an open field firing from very close range. So had there not been people there, police officers there to engage him, this could have potentially been much worse.
There has been some reporting about the gunman that he was, in fact, a Bernie Sanders supporter, that he had on social media said things about Donald Trump that were very critical. That's about all we know. I don't think we want to go too far into that because obviously the FBI is investigating. This is a federal case, of course. Tell us about the game itself, which is a charity event, as I understand it, that they were preparing for.
That's right. So this game is going to happen on Thursday. It is, in fact, going to go forward, we've learned. The congressional leadership announced this morning that it would go ahead. One of my colleagues reported there were, there was a lot of applause when that was announced. But this was a practice, basically just batting practice at a field in a very idyllic suburb in Northern Virginia. There's a dog park right next to the baseball field. You know, it's worth noting that there are a lot of people in the dog park as well who are just steps from the gunmen who all, you know, kind of hit the deck when shots began going off. So, again, while Hodgkinson's apparent targets in the shooting were the people playing baseball, the GOP baseball players, there were a lot of other people there, a lot of innocent bystanders who could have potentially been hit by gunfire as well.
Who were the other people that were, in fact, hit?
So, you know, it's interesting. It's sort of a small cross-section of Washington. You had Representative Scalise. You had a congressional aide. You had a lobbyist. And then among those who were almost hit, there were, you know, a lot of people just working out in the YMCA or at the dog park. A bullet actually traveled into the YMCA. And one interesting thing that's just coming to light now is that, we're learning, and I was told by a YMCA member that the gunman, Hodgkinson, had actually been hanging out in the lobby of the YMCA, which is adjacent to the baseball field, for some weeks. So this is something I expect the FBI will have more to tell us about in the days to come. But that's sort of one of the ongoing questions here, is why this guy showed up in Alexandria, why he picked out this specific ballpark. But he clearly had picked it out, and he was there, you know, sort of learning the routines of people coming and going on the field for at least the last several weeks.
Strange, too, that he would have asked the congressman if this was where the Republicans were playing. He might already have known that. We don't, of course, know what he was doing, perhaps to disguise himself. I take it no action in Congress today. They have taken off. All of them are saying that this simply draws them together, that they will be unified as members of that body, as public servants. The president has said the same thing. So politics for the moment has been forgotten.
It seems like it. And one of the more interesting voices to enter this conversation has been that of Representative Gabrielle Giffords, who was herself a victim of a mass shooting some years back, and who made a very moving statement just to the effect that, you know, anyone can be a victim of this violence, and her heart goes out to those who were victims today in Congress.
Okay.
So, I think that's right, that it does seem like politics has kind of been put on hold for the day.
At least for the moment. Peter Jamieson with The Washington Post, many thanks.
Thank you.
In a moment, when they get back to business as usual, can Democrats form a common strategy for the upcoming elections? This is To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on back with To the Point. As the era of Donald Trump just gets underway, Democrats are divided. Liberal activists dream of impeachment and enacting a single-payer health system. Party regulars just want to get back to governing. Yesterday, the primary election for governor of Virginia was a test of both Democratic factions. Alex Burns is a political reporter for The New York Times. Alex, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So this was an unexpectedly wide victory, I take it, for the Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam. Tell us what was expected as opposed to what happened.
Right. No, that's absolutely correct. I think Northam was seen as the favorite going into the primary. He was not seen as someone who was likely to win by 10 points. He really had the full support of the state's political establishment. He had a well of backing from black voters across the state. But he had a formidable opponent in the form of Tom Perriello, this liberal former congressman who was endorsed by Bernie Sanders, endorsed by Elizabeth Warren, but who, we found out last night, really never cracked Northam's base of support across the state.
So what does that tell us about Virginia, and what sort of signal do you think it will send to Democrats around the country?
I think, for starters, it tells Democrats that an endorsement from Bernie Sanders is not the be-all, end-all of Democratic primary politics, that, you know, someone like Ralph Northam had the support of the state's governor, the state's two senators. He was a longtime elected official with his own network of support on the left in the state, and the notion that an out-of-state politician like Sanders, no matter how prominent, no matter how beloved he is on the left, can come in and just overturn a primary election, that simply did not pan out.
What about Elizabeth Warren? She also has been considered a very important voice on that side of the party.
And I don't think anything that happened last night should raise questions about that. But what it does tell us is that there may be limits to the impact of both Sanders and Warren outside their states, outside of federal elections. You know, this is something that we've seen for a while on the Republican side, that a lot of the activist politics that have been so influential in congressional elections, in Senate races, and in the presidential race have not necessarily translated into state-level elections for jobs like governor.
And now there's an election, special election, to fill the seat of Tom Price, congressman from Georgia, who is now in the president's cabinet. What's happening there, and how is it comparable to what we saw in Virginia? This is, of course, in a suburb of Atlanta.
Well, I hesitate to make any kind of firm pronouncements, because what we saw last night is that a lot of the polling on that race was flawed. But at least what we think is going on in Georgia is that you have a real knife's edge contest between John Ossoff, this 30-year-old first-time candidate running as a moderate Democrat, and Karen Handel, longtime local and state office holder running as a pretty conservative candidate on the Republican side. It's a conservative district, so on paper, this ought to be a good race for Karen Handel. But we've just seen an outpouring of energy on the Democratic side, and you've seen a really effective effort, or at least it appears to be an effective effort, by Ossoff to work over those voters in the center, and even on the center right, to try to show that a Democrat, even in the age of Bernie Sanders, can compete for folks who normally vote Republican.
Now, you call him a moderate, but he has been endorsed by Bernie Sanders, has he not?
It's a complicated question, actually, that Sanders has. Back in April, Sanders wouldn't quite answer the question of whether he considered John Ossoff a progressive. That caused an uproar at the time, and Sanders calmed things down by saying, look, we'd be better off if he were elected to Congress. I don't know if you call that a full-throated endorsement. He certainly prefers Ossoff over the Republican, but he's not done anything to help his campaign. And I'm not sure that Ossoff would want him to. Georgia Democrats and National Democrats who are involved in that race feel pretty strongly that they need to be careful about injecting national issues, national partisan fault lines into that race, because Republicans do outnumber Democrats by a hefty number in that district.
Now, back to Virginia. What about that state? It's said to be turning purple, but this was a place where the Tea Party really got underway.
It is. It's been a while since you've had a really significant Republican success there on the statewide level. That you've had one Republican governor elected there in the last 20 years. You've had a series of now Democratic senators elected. And even last year, when Donald Trump was winning states like Ohio and Michigan, Hillary Clinton managed to carry Virginia. So, you know, nobody's saying that Virginia is not a competitive state, that it's not a purple state, but you are starting to hear people talk about it as a state that may be purple verging on light blue.
Alex Burns, again, national political reporter for The New York Times. Melissa Byrne is a veteran of the Bernie Sanders campaign. She now serves on the Democratic National Committee's Transition Committee. Good to have you on our show.
Thanks for having me.
Are you disappointed about what happened yesterday in Virginia?
Well, yeah. I mean, I supported Tom. I had a lot of friends on the race. But here's what I'm excited about. The Democrats completely crushed the Republican. If this was California, the general election would be Ralph versus Tom. Edward Glebsey only got 160,000 votes. Tom Perriello got 239,000 votes. And so while Alex was talking about, well, Bernie Sanders, you know, can't really add, but look what happened. You had two great candidates, two progressives, one that was backed by the standard bearers of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. And what did that do? That increased Democratic turnout to the point that the Democrats overall completely crushed the two Republican candidates. And that is exciting, and it shows why we need primaries and why it's important that we're all in it and all fighting for our values, because Democratic values are the values that Virginians want to have in office.
And you mentioned that the two Democrats might be running against each other if this was in California. In California, the winners of the primary are the top vote getters, regardless of what party they are in. So even the man who came in second in Virginia did better, you're saying, than the Republicans. Alex Burns, back to you with the New York Times. Give us some background on the Republicans and what happened there.
Well, listen, first of all, it's absolutely true that Democrats massively outperformed Republicans in Virginia last night. And when you talk to Republicans today, there is a sense of grave concern about that election, that it may not be something that they can really keep as a close race between now and November because of the fundamentals of the state and because of the nature of the two parties and their candidates at this stage. A big part of that concern is that Republican primary, it's not just that the overall turnout was low, it's that the heavy, heavy favorite to win that race, Ed Gillespie, barely squeaked through the primary against candidate Corey Stewart, who was really seen as a fringe figure in the Virginia Republican Party. He ran a campaign largely focused on defending Confederate monuments and Confederate heritage, even as the state clearly moves more and more away from embracing that part of its history, whereas Ed Gillespie has run as a conventional Republican candidate talking about cutting taxes, cutting spending. It's not clear that that message resonated for Gillespie in the primary, let alone whether it will resonate for him in the general election.
So more evidence then that, as you indicated earlier, given these numbers, Virginia is moving toward the blue, and the Republican Party in Virginia, however, at the same time, I take it, is becoming more extreme.
Well, and this is something that you have seen in states like California, where the weaker the Republican Party gets at the local level, the more influence hardliners have. That makes it, you know, eventually that's how a party ends up in a downward spiral where they lose elections and the losses beget other losses because the people who can win no longer get the support from their own side that they would need.
Let me turn to Emmanuel Cleaver. He is a Democratic congressman from Missouri's 5th District. He's a former chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you.
What do you make of the Virginia election, first of all, and what we've heard about that state and what it might mean elsewhere around the country?
Well, I think all of the signs are good coming out of Virginia for the Democratic Party. The problem we've got to watch, I think, is to refuse to allow a Tea Party like wing to develop in our party, because all that's going to do is create the kind of rifts that Republicans are lamenting. And I think the race in Virginia does suggest that there are people who are not interested in seeing the Democratic Party have, frankly, a so-called regular Democrat and the extremely left ideological wing. That's the problem. That's when we're going to have some difficulties. And so I think things are working out. We can't have a party where there is a me. It's got to be a party of we, and because anything else, I think, will slowly diminish the impact of our party, not just in Virginia, but around the whole country.
Let me go back to Melissa Byrne. Now, once again, formerly with the Bernie Sanders campaign, member of the Democratic National Committee's Transition Committee. What about the fact that with the Tea Party, the Republicans have managed to start taking over local offices, and then moved up to the point where they now control all the legislatures and the governorships of something like 30 states. Is that what you were hoping would happen to the Democrats, not perhaps by as an extreme a group, but comparatively speaking, as the Tea Party, but with the so-called Bernie-crats?
I think if you remember that, like, the Bernie-crats, as you call them, they're not the extreme of the party. They're rank-and-file Democrats. And they are new people that have gotten involved into the Democratic Party. And what we're going to see happening is people are running for – they're running. People are getting on local committees. People are starting to run for office at the lower level. And this is just a starting point. And you're going to see this growing. You're going to see more engagement at the local level because we're not really that far apart on issues. Like, we are – you know, that sometimes people like to have it look like everybody is so spread apart and there's all this conflict. But – you know, we're all people that are just working to make this country as good as we can, to make sure that people have dignity, to make sure that we get rid of economic inequality and that we are focused on the issues. And it's great. People are going to get involved. They're going to get engaged. Change doesn't happen overnight. It happens in the basements of, like, office buildings and people's living rooms as you go to all these meetings and do all the work. And you're going to see us winning, and it's going to be, I look forward, if the numbers in Virginia hold, with how many Democrats were engaged by having a really robust, positive debate about the future of the Democratic Party and different candidates, you're going to see that happen, and we're going to have a really great 2018, and that's going to lead us into 2020.
But Congressman Cleaver, you seem to be worried that the Democrats might, in fact, see the kind of divisions that we see now in the Republican Party, which I take it you think might be somewhat fatal to their effort to take over, particularly at the state level. How concerned are you about it?
Well, I'm concerned. I think many people around here are concerned because we're finding that Bernie Sanders candidates or those who claim allegiance to him are opposing members of the party who they say are not liberal enough and not progressive enough. And in many of those cases, the individuals are in the top 10% of most liberal legislators. So, of course, I'm concerned. I think when you spend all of your money fighting in a primary, a person who allegedly has very similar political ideas, you're going to go into the general election with some weakness. And that's just real. It's politics 101. And so that's the danger, is that you have to slug it out in Democratic primaries and spend over 50% of your money. You're going to be behind, especially in a race where the Republican Party puts as much money in it as they're doing down in Georgia 6 right now.
Let me go to David Rolfe just for a moment before we have to go to a break. He is president of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU 775, in the Seattle area. He's author of The Fight for 15, The Right Wage for a Working America. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me on, Warren.
Where do people in the labor movement, particularly those that are fighting for 15, stand when it comes to the two parts of the Democratic Party, or are they voting for Donald Trump?
Well, right now, most workers in America who make less than $15 an hour are actually staying home because they haven't found anything about either major party to appeal to them. In Virginia, probably 2 million low-wage workers in that state, and I bet you not more than 10 or 15% of them were likely to have voted in a spring primary election. The reality is that there has been a 40-year war on the middle class and on the working class in this country, not because we became a poorer country, but because we chose to redistribute wealth differently. And the workers who make, the 50% of American workers who make less than $17 an hour, right now are looking at both political parties and wondering who stands for them.
So, obviously, then, they are up for grabs. And which way do you think they're liable to go, given the divisions we see in the Democratic Party?
Well, historically, the Democrats were the party of working class America. But as we saw this last year, we had Donald Trump make an effort to peel off segments of the working class. Although most of his voters were affluent, about a third were working class voters. And I think that as unions have declined and there are fewer workers in organizations that get them out to vote, get them registered, help educate them about the issues, that there is a real risk for the Democratic Party that in part through maybe some allegiance switching, but mainly through voters just staying home, because if there's no one fighting for them economically, why would they turn out to vote?
Thank you. We're going to take a break, as I said. We're going to talk about the commander-in-chief giving up power to the Pentagon on our talking point later. First, we'll resume this conversation in just a moment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Our question today, whether the Democrats, will they divide into two, such as the Republicans have done? Will they be able to hold it together? Have they, in fact, lost much of their original coalition by the fact that people in the labor movement, as we have just heard, particularly those at the lower end of the scale, just aren't participating anymore in politics? Thomas Edsel is a professor at the Columbia School of Journalism. He's author of Chain Reaction, The Impact of Race, Rights, and Taxes on American Politics. He's also wrote Building Red America, The New Conservative Coalition, and The Drive for Permanent Power. Good to have you on our show.
Good to be here with you, Warren.
All right. Let's turn away from the red America for the moment and talk about the blue America, such as it exists. So what do you say to what we just heard from David Rolfe, that in fact, over the years, the party has given up its traditional support for those who are at the bottom end of the scale? They're just staying home.
I think Rolfe was right on, but he actually points to a central problem the Democratic Party now has. It has changed from the working class party of the 1930s and 40s. It's now become, in the main, a top-down party. There are more college graduates who are voting Democrat than there are non-college graduates. It's also strongest in very successful cities among constituencies, the high-tech area, who are doing very well. The problem that Rolfe points out is that to expand, especially into the service class, these voters need some rationale for voting for the Democrats, and that does require pretty aggressive support for policies like the $15 minimum wage, improving working conditions in hospitals and fast food facilities. But it's a question whether the Democratic Party has the will to do that, given its top-down characteristics.
Let me go back to Melissa Byrne, again, formerly with the Bernie Sanders campaign. This would suggest that the kinds of things that Senator Sanders has talked about, up to and including single-payer insurance, health insurance, would appeal to the kind of voters that the Democrats really need to get back.
I mean, absolutely. I think we saw, I know I personally saw it around the country, it was on the campaign and doing other organizing as well, that people, they want single payer, they want free college, they want a minimum wage of $15 an hour, because at the end of the day, everybody wants to live in dignity and to be able to work towards achieving, you know, the great American dream. And we do that through commitment to the issues. And just to address a concern that Representative Cleaver had a few minutes ago, I don't think that there's going to be this big mass thing to, like, primary everybody in Congress, all the Democrats. There's, like, one fringe group that's doing that, and they're not going to get any traction. So I don't think we need to worry about seeing people that were on the Bernie campaign and people who supported Bernie just going all over the place, like, primarying everybody. We're going to see people, like, being very targeted, being very smart with it, and building up a Democratic Party that wins elections, because all that matters is winning, so that way we have a speakership starting in 2019 so we can start pushing really good policy.
But we heard earlier, and Congressman Cleaver, let me go back to you on this, that a lot of money went into Virginia to support the candidate who was the furthest on the left, and he was crushed.
Yes, and we're seeing that happen in elections around the country. But at the same time, when you put a lot of money and energy into to those battles, which you have to do, incidentally, if you want to win, it reduces or diminishes what you're able to do in the next election. It's like anything else. You know, you put all of your energy into the first half of an athletic contest. You know, you're going to be worn out a little bit more in the second half. So, I think we've got to be real. I do think that Senator Sanders has tremendous value. Here's what we got to be careful of doing. Number one, President Trump went around the country promising everything that he was going to bring the coal industry back. He was going to bring all of the jobs back to the Rust Belt. Well, the coal industry is not going to come back. It's just not going to do it. We're going to move to solar. We're going to move to wind and cellulosic ethanol and many other things. Democrats can't go out and promise a bunch of things that, look, I'm a legislator. I know what's possible. I compromised and voted for the Affordable Care Act because I wanted single payer. But I compromised and voted for it. I remember the night when President Obama told us in a telephone conference that he was going to drop the single payer. In that case, I think we could have won it because we received no Republican votes at all. But what I think we got to be careful about doing is saying things that are not going to happen, telling the public we're going to get it, because every time we do that, the public trust drops just a little bit more.
Emanuel Cleaver, once again, Democrat from Missouri and former head of the Congressional Black Caucus. David Rolfe, back to you with the SEIU 775 in the northwest part of the country. Will your members and will people who are staying home now because they don't like either party want to hear more about single payer and free college? Will they make those issues, do you think, conditional to going back to the polls? And might the Democrats have a problem if they don't go that far in attracting those voters?
You know, I think that bread and butter kitchen table economics is very motivating for workers, for working class people in general across the United States. Of course, union members already vote in higher proportion than the general public because they're in an organization that can work to turn them out. Mm. But for the vast majority of American workers who are both low wage and non-union, unless there is, I'd say, bold, morally compelling reasons, we see what happens with working class voter turnout. It's at historic lows. So I think whether you're talking about $15 wages, the right to form a union, whether you're talking about, more substantial health care reform and things like debt-free college, you really do need some big motivators. You know, President Kennedy didn't say that we might go to the moon. He said we will go to the moon, not because it's easy, because it's hard. And I actually think that when political leaders, organizational leaders demand the best of themselves and their country, we often respond positively.
What about the argument we just heard from Congressman Cleaver, though? If you make promises you can't make good on, then you're in bigger trouble than ever. If single payer isn't likely to happen, you didn't use that phrase. You said different kind of health reform. What about free college? Are those things that you think are realistic enough that Democrats ought to promise them, or do they have to be careful?
It took decades for us to win the 8-hour day between the 1880s and the 1930s. It took decades. It took more than decades to win suffrage for women. And these days, we're seeing big, big shifts like marriage equality and $15 wages happen in relatively short periods of time. I believe we would have had in Seattle, which is the first big city to adopt a $15 minimum wage, and where, by the way, unemployment is now below 2.7%. I believe we would have had to spend just as much time, effort, and political will going to 975. But people aren't motivated by small incremental change. They want to believe in and fight for big issues, and I think that's part of why the $15 minimum wage fight has been so compelling.
Let me go back to Thomas Edsall, our professor at the Columbia School of Journalism. You've been looking at organizations like Resist and Indivisible, which are democratic organizations organizing at the grassroots level. What are they doing, and how do they fit into this conversation?
Well, as far as I can tell, and I haven't looked that thoroughly into them, there's a huge amount of activity taking place in Democratic-leaning areas primarily, but all over the place, including Republican districts. And right now, it's scattershot all over the place, although it may translate into significant boosts for Democrats in 2018. You could argue that it needs more central leadership, but it may be that this is just kind of an anarchistic kind of movement that centralization does not really help. But one of the dangers is that there is a temptation with all the energy that's there to go after Democratic incumbents as opposed to Republicans in the general election, partly because they're sort of easier targets in Democratic areas where many of these groups are forming. And it could be kind of an internal suicide, just the kind that Representative Cleaver was talking about. But on the whole, I think there's clearly a huge amount of energy and activity taking place on the left side of the political spectrum.
Does there appear to be coordination by the Democratic National Committee, or is it not part of this?
From what I've been able to learn, which I say is limited, it looks to me like it's pretty random all over the place without central coordination, and that there are even competing groups within this larger movement. But again, I'm not sure that trying to place central controls on it at this point. It could be that there should be much more coordination, and these groups could use things like all the new voter lists that have been developed, very sophisticated voter lists that give you descriptions on what the leanings are of individuals throughout a whole district. And sometimes that costs money, and those groups could use those resources that the Democratic Party is better equipped to provide. And it might be that the party could take a more active role in that area, providing these kind of resources that really could help these groups make a difference in the general election.
So, Melissa Byrne, back to you. You're on the Democratic National Committee transition team. We saw the Carter division we've talked about when there was a race for a chair of the Democratic National Committee. Tom Perez was the winner, the more centrist of the two candidates. What is the party doing about all this, and how likely is it that organizations, we heard terms like anarchistic and random, are going to go off on their own, perhaps challenge other Democrats? You said you don't think that's likely, but how do you stop it?
Well, I think the issue is stopping it. I think it's also like a misnomer to describe Chairman Perez as like the centrist. I think we're really lucky to have an incredibly progressive chair of the Democratic National Committee, whose first move was to make Keith Ellison his deputy chair, which shows that there is a huge commitment to unifying the party and showing that we are one big team. As Tom always describes it as Team Tom, we are all one big Democratic team, and we're all working together. I think that Tom's describing things as like anarchistic is a little bit overblown. What we're seeing is that people are really mad about Donald Trump. They're mad that he's banning Muslims, that he's attacking all of our rights, that he's attacking Planned Parenthood, he's attacking health care, he wants to, you know, throw people off the Affordable Care Act. And these are things that hurt people and they're really bad. And what we're seeing is we're seeing people organize in their communities. People are getting together, like 10 people here, 20 people there, and all that is adding up to really huge numbers. And we're seeing that happen because people are mad and they're involved and they're engaged. And they're seeing that the progressive side is where they want to go. And I think it's going to be great. You're not going to see that many, like, real primaries happening. And when they do, it brings out more people. Like, the lesson from Virginia isn't that Lieutenant Governor Northam had to spend more money for the primary. The lesson from Virginia is that more Democrats came out, more people came out to vote Democratic in Virginia than they did for Republicans. Tom Perriello's entry into the race helped Northam. It got people engaged. It brought out another 230,000 voters to be involved and engaged, and that will only translate to ensuring that we win in November.
Okay, so the more liberal of the candidates, then, you think, helped the one who was more conventional to win the election just simply by bringing out voters in the Democratic Party. David Rolfe, back to you. I understand you're in Washington. You're talking to members of Congress, Emanuel Cleaver and others. Are you hearing the same thing from them, most of them, that we heard from him? Are they worried about being challenged by people on the left as we go into the 2018 election?
Just for accuracy, I haven't met the representative.
that we're on the phone.
Oh,
with
okay.
Today, but,
all right.
But I am in D.C. this part of this week. Listen, I actually, my friends and allies in Congress that I've been talking to are not particularly concerned with being primaried. I think they're very concerned, first of all, about resisting the Trump agenda and preventing the, whether it's the catastrophe of having 24 million people lose their health coverage and potentially millions lose their jobs as the healthcare sector of the economy contracts, whether it's the really obscene violations of human and civil rights that are being propagated and condoned by this administration. I think that is a principle on the minds of people I think are good legislators and who are trying their best.
Okay. Congressman Cleaver, we're just about out of time, but how concerned are you, how concerned are other members of Congress that so much attention is being paid on Donald Trump and the Russians that the so-called bread and butter issues we heard about earlier from David Rolf might be ignored?
Well, all of the air is being sucked out of the legislative branch of government because of what's going on with President Trump and the Russians and the investigations. I need to say, because I think it's critically important to this conversation, if the Democrats are going to take back control of the House or win the House and the Senate, we've got to change the way we think. For example, there's not one single white Democrat elected to Congress from the South. Not in Florida, not Georgia, not Alabama, not Mississippi, not Louisiana, not one. And one of the reasons is that when a Democrat starts running and we do the litmus test in one of the southern states, and he or she says, well, you know, I have a different kind of opinion on birth control. And we say, oh, well, you're out. We can't support you because you're different. We'll never win back those seats. Look, I'm a liberal, coming out of the civil rights movement. I am clearly a liberal in a district with only 22% black.
But you're willing to make compromises, is what you're saying, with more conservative people in order to get them elected.
That's right. And if we don't do it, we're going to lose. And it's just that simple. And we can't apply the litmus test to all these folk who would be otherwise good candidates, but they may not embrace one of the traditional democratic principles. And because of that, we ostracize them, and we continue to give those seats to people all over the South. And that's got to stop if we're going to win.
Okay, this is all the time we have, but we're going to leave it on that note. And I want to thank all of you very much for being with us. Emmanuel Cleaver, once again, a Democrat from Missouri, former head of the Congressional Black Caucus. David Rolf with SEIU 775 in Seattle. Thomas Edsel at the Columbian School of Journalism. Melissa Byrne, formerly with the Bernie Sanders campaign, now with the Democratic National Committee. And our earlier guest, Alex Burns, a national political reporter for the New York Times. Thank you all very much for being on our program today. In a moment, President Trump makes good on another campaign promise, more authority to the Pentagon. This is To the Point from PRI. Well, we're not here with today's talking point. During his campaign, Donald Trump said American generals were not being listened to. He vowed to give them increased authority. Now he has given the defense secretary and former general James Mattis unilateral command of the action in Afghanistan. Here's what the defense secretary had to say yesterday.
I understand the urgency. I understand it's my responsibility. We're not winning in Afghanistan right now.
Paul McCleary covers national security and the Pentagon for Foreign Policy. Good to have you with us.
Good afternoon.
So what do you think that means? Is General Mattis going to increase the troop count in Afghanistan?
Pentagon officials and the head of the U.S. military command in Kabul, General Nicholson, have been calling for more troops for at least several months in Afghanistan, and it looks to be somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 more troops that they want there, they wouldn't be taking a war-fighting role necessarily. It looks like they would be trainers, advisors, working with military commanders, but also probably going out in the field with smaller Afghan units advising, kind of like they're doing in Syria and Iraq right now with the Syrian rebels and the Iraqi army.
Okay, just to bring our listeners up to date, 8,400 troops are there now. Three U.S. soldiers were killed there on Saturday, shot by an Afghan commando. So six have died in combat this year. So they are not then, as you're saying, so much necessarily in the line of fire.
That's likely the plan. I mean, the plan hasn't been finalized yet. There was word that it was done, and they had wanted to brief it to President Trump last month. But I don't think that briefing ever happened. And I think they went back to the drawing board and were making some tweaks to the plan. But yes, I mean, it looks like 3,000 to 5,000 is the number that's been quoted for weeks now. And that's what General Nicholson says, roughly his shortfall. They're also trying to get more NATO countries to supply more troops. But yeah, they won't be. Most of the troops will be on bases, training and advising, but quite a few would be in the field, and they would be in some danger. I mean, as we've seen, not only the attacks from some Afghan soldiers that have happened over time, but in places like Iraq or Syria or even Afghanistan, there have been some firefights where these guys get close to the front line, they get caught up in it, and they have the right to self-defense, so that ends up being a fight. So it wouldn't be a risk-free deployment for the new soldiers.
So, once again, we just heard Defense Secretary Mattis say we're not winning in Afghanistan. My understanding is that the Taliban holds a very large percentage of Afghanistan. What would winning look like? What does he mean?
That's the question. I mean, that's the question we've been struggling to answer since October 2001. Winning here would look like an Afghan government that can handle a lower level of violence on its own, probably with some American help, occasional airstrikes, continued training and advising for years to come. I mean, this doesn't – what Pentagon officials are saying now is they don't want to put any timelines on the U.S. involvement there like President Obama did. And they're looking for a long-term engagement for U.S. troops in Afghanistan to help support the Afghan government, but also to use the country as a springboard for doing counterterrorism operations in the region, something that makes the Pakistanis and the Iranians who share borders with Iran or with Afghanistan nervous. So, you know, by taking this action, you're also making other countries in the region pretty uncomfortable and not putting any sort of limitation or timeline on when this might end.
So it does sound like then the forever war, as it's often called, is that what we're talking about, even though it's a lower level of warfare than there was, for example, in Vietnam?
It would be a years-long engagement. I mean, the United States has already been there with NATO allies for 16 years. President Obama wanted to end the war. It didn't happen. And I think that the Pentagon now is saying that with the Taliban being resurgent, the Islamic State in now active in Afghanistan, with Talqani network still very active, that this fight isn't over anytime soon, and there'll have to be some level of U.S. military involvement for years to come in order just to try and keep the Afghan government stable and in control of a large segment of the population. Probably not the whole population, probably not the whole country, but they're aiming for a majority of the population.
Why is it so important for the U.S. to be involved in trying to stop the growth of those organizations that you mentioned in Afghanistan? Won't they just simply crop up someplace else? Are we in a situation where we're likely to expend a lot of resources without really ever getting what we want out of it?
The United States has already spent over $70 billion to train and equip the Afghan security forces. There's already been a huge investment, and it looks to be about $5 billion a year going forward to keep them supplied and equipped. But there is concern in the Pentagon and in the White House that if we leave Afghanistan, as much of the country is already an ungoverned space, it would only get worse. And the Taliban and the Haqqani network, the groups that go back and forth between Pakistan and Afghanistan, they would just grow in strength and potentially pose a risk to the United States and to the West, and the governments in Kabul, governments in Pakistan, lead over into India. So the new catchphrase here is they're taking a regional approach, which I assume means that they want to engage the Pakistanis, maybe lean a little bit harder on the Pakistanis to try to clamp down on these groups that are going back and forth over the border.
Very quickly, giving full command to the Pentagon, as President Trump has done, he is the commander-in-chief. Is he giving up? Is he abdicating a presidential prerogative?
Well, no strategy has been officially signed off on. It sounds like allowing General Mattis, or Jim Mattis, Secretary of Defense, to make the decision on the number of troops. I mean, the troops by themselves isn't a strategy. So he has control of that, and as the president hasn't signed off any larger strategy, we don't really know what's going to come next. He is giving a pretty unprecedented amount of power to the Secretary of Defense to make decisions and to deploy troops and to empower his lower commanders lower down the chain to take airstrikes and launch attacks. I mean, that large bomb that was dropped about 2 months ago in Afghanistan, General Nicholson in Afghanistan made the decision to do that, and that wasn't even briefed to Jim Mattis, Secretary of Defense, before he did it. So each level of power is allowing their subordinates more and more freedom all the way down the chain, and we haven't really seen this before. So we're entering a new era here.
Okay. Once again, you mentioned the so-called mother of all bombs decided right. by a relatively local commander rather than by the Pentagon, let alone the White House. So obviously, command is moving down the chain, and we'll see what that means in the future. Paul McClure, it's great to talk with you, and thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you very much.
Again, Paul McClure covers national security at the Pentagon for Foreign Policy. I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.